You're listening to On the Breath, the power of voice in the world. And I'm your host, SJ Harrison. Hello, I'm very excited today to be here with my friend Carlos Aguirre, aka Infinite. He is a beatboxer, rapper, and teaching artist, and we met in the late 90s. So that's my intro on how I know Carlos, and it was actually through theater work. At the time, Carlos was acting and also rapping as part of that. And before we started recording today, we were talking about voiceover on Netflix. So I'd love to really start there, Carlos.
Yes, 100%. Hello. It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. We were basically just talking about, you know, how I approach that kind of process inside of a recording session. And we were talking about this most recent voiceover that I did for Netflix, which was for a children's animated show. And I was supposed to be this rapper car, like a car that rapped. And they didn't really ask for any of my beatboxing stuff, which is my vocal percussion, all the stuff, all that stuff. They didn't really necessarily ask for it, but I found myself in the session after doing the rap. I was like, hey, do you guys want me to, you know, I just asked. I said, hey, do you want me to do some of my beatbox stuff? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, just like sort of for fun. And I did it. And I think it ended up making it into the track because they had a track already. And I think they may have used some of the beatboxing in the track. So that's really cool. But, you know, so that was one little learning experience that, you know, you have some power when you're in a voiceover. Mm-hmm. You are the talent. They are asking for your voice. And if you have a capacity that's beyond what they might know, then speak up about it. You know, that's just something that I learned. You know, I was like, I'm not going to be shy about it. And so yeah, even though they weren't asking for it, and even though you're sort of on this time scale that's being paid, you don't want to over intrude on your time or whatever. I was just offering it. And sure enough, I ended up staying longer and doing that, which was really great. But while I was doing the rapping, I thought about, I thought about what would be good for this character is if there was some movement, because I'm a car that's moving. And while I was rapping, I was thinking to myself, I'm sort of, you know, just kind of standing here, you know, without being able to really flex and move around. And there's no space really to do that. It was a vocal booth. It was the very typical sort of vocal booth situation, cramped, and you kind of just have to deliver and perform, and there's this pressure. And so I didn't feel free enough to move while I was doing the work, but I think it would be kind of advantageous and fun if I had a chance, and I think it would serve the project, the voiceover, better. And you had mentioned that was part of the process that can be done, where they can actually have a real, like, Foley type system where people can actually use real sound.
Yeah, so that was my experiences as a playwright, as a young playwright, having my first play produced on BBC Radio. And we were talking, Carlos and I were talking about how in England, there's still a lot of radio plays. It's still a big part of what the BBC does. And so they have big sound studios. If the characters, such as in my play, are walking, they are walking literally as they talk. If they're getting into a car, they're getting into a pretty good mock-up of a car and opening the door and speaking behind a windscreen.
Right.
So the understanding how nuanced sound is, but more to your point, the understanding that voice is an embodied process. So I had another experience of having a play recorded where that didn't exist and sound was put on afterwards. Of course, at the BBC, they're also going to put on a lot of sound afterwards.
Right.
But anything that is being physically done by the actors, they do their best to do it physically.
Yes.
So to the other experience I had where everyone was sitting, I was actually very disappointed with the result because the voices, with the exception of some very skilled moments, the voices were rather flat. You felt you were listening to people reading. And in BBC radio plays, it's very rare that you would feel that people are reading. The voice comes through the body. So as a voice coach, and we were talking, Carlos, about how you know this as a performer, as a beatboxer. It's all about your whole voice, and you have to use your breath very dynamically, which is what I'm training people to do for public speaking. So we do very big physical movements for some of the vocal warm-ups while we're vocalizing.
Yeah. And also, you know, being someone who's comfortable speaking in front of people, I've always had a large, like, lung capacity. Like, I don't, I've always been sort of like, that hasn't been an issue. So it's very comfortable for me. And I think people in general, we don't breathe properly. We sort of breathe very, like, shallow. And when you have diaphragmatic breathing going on, just in general, it sort of becomes kind of just, I don't know if it's natural, but it just becomes not hard to tap into. It's not difficult to speak, because I think what happens is when you're in front of folks, that all your energy gets kind of sucked up a little bit, and that also takes some of your breath, and your breathing becomes shallow anyway. So for me, it's all connected. And the body itself, like, as a beatboxer, when I perform beatboxing, I don't just stand there, right? I move, and I use my body. And in fact, one of my favorite beatboxers, Kenny Muhammad, I saw him live with a small band. And he would straddle the stage. He would sort of do almost a sumo
type. I love that image.
Yeah, almost a sumo type position while he was beatboxing. And all that breath was just coming from this, like, guttural underneath, big, you know, sound beneath him. And that movement itself informed the beatboxing. And that's why they're so connected. So for me, it makes total sense that, you know, for the beatboxing, I can't help it but move my hands and move my body. Like, you will never catch me just standing still beatboxing, which would be an odd sight anyway.
Well, and if you're not watching this on YouTube, if you're listening to this as a podcast, you will not know that both Carlos and I are very gestural. I notice it as I'm listening to you talking about movement. Your gestures, your body movement are fully present in what you're saying. And of course, since that's my training too, I suddenly noticed that about myself as well. We're just really moving a lot.
Yes.
And it starts to align when you're able to be free enough to, first of all, and also have some technique around breathing really deeply, diaphragmatic breathing, then allowing that to move you, that big movement that's happening in the center of your body, allowing that to move you through your arms, allowing it to align with what you're saying. Suddenly you're a much freer speaker.
And more engaging to watch, to listen to, because speaking is not like, as someone who's sitting down watching or whatever, standing down, whatever, looking at the speaker, you're not just engaged in your listening skills. Obviously you're watching, and I think there's many times when someone can be saying something very sort of important, very almost, you know, the content is engaging, but the speaker is not, and they're not really fleshing out this great writing that could be in the speech or in the whatever they're presenting. Yeah, when the speaker is not engaging, the listener is just not engaged. It's sort of like, that's just kind of, you know what I mean? Common sense.
So this reminds me of something else. Steve Jobs became known as a great speaker in business. He came to have that reputation.
Yeah.
But when I look at his earlier speeches, there's a very well-known speech at Stanford. I could be wrong on the year, but I think it's in the early 2000s. He's not innately a dynamic speaker, but what he was able to do was write a speech that was beautifully constructed to play to his strengths. And then it was easy to lift the meaning in, because his speeches are very simple, but also beautifully constructed. So he had some antithesis, storytelling, a lot of storytelling.
Yeah.
And perhaps he was one of the people, in fact, who initiated the idea of storytelling in business in terms of big presentations.
Yeah.
But it points to your own material. You can construct material that suits your skills and your style, and then you can, they begin to affect each other. So by writing something that feels authentic to you and working on a good structure of the writing, you start to develop your own style as much as you are informing the writing with the style that you already have.
Yeah, it's sort of like putting on a glove that's already made for you. It's not, you know, this way you can flex freely and it doesn't feel constricting and it's all just, fits like a glove. Yeah, totally.
And that's got to be true for you when you're writing the work that you perform.
Yes. And I mean, that's what my my Telltale Heart piece is kind of what was designed for. I wrote a rap beatbox adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart. And I found myself being like, oh, I'm an actor and I love doing plays. And I'm like, but I also really like music and I like beatboxing and I like rapping. And so I've always wanted to figure out how could I create something that I could, obviously, you know us from Beatbox or Rapparetta, the rap opera piece that we did many years ago. But also I wanted to find a way where I could use this, my everything, the vehicle, the vehicle, which is how to do something that involved me laying down music beatbox wise with my mouth, and then also then putting my voice over it, telling this story, and then also taking a classic story like Telltale Heart and flipping it and adapting it to rap, which is rhythmic, which is has a lot of syncopation, which is much different than just a different kind of syncopation, I should say, more quicker up-tempo syncopation. But so for me, it's a big part of my work. And also I find that if I can't, like as an actor, if I can't move my body while I'm engaging my voice for like a particular scene or something that I feel is like right for the character, it's harder to memorize those lines because movement is very tied into how the rhythm of how I memorize, where I'm standing, what I'm doing. And I don't get locked into the choices, but I do sometimes feel like navigating the stage as a map and the different areas that I land on are little territories that I can remember. It's sort of like muscle memory, and that helps the lines get memorized as well. And I know you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And the body, this is taking me into another place, which is that the body remembers. So the way in which experience is stored in the body, and we can have dis-ease from traumatic experiences that are still stored in the body. Mm-hmm. This is really a holistic concept, but I've seen it. There's a lot of research on that now that's apparent around, early childhood trauma and the instances, particularly of women who have early childhood trauma who then develop autoimmune disease. And when it's very early, the brain, my understanding is, there isn't the psychological analysis that happens when you're even, say, nine. When you're nine, you know what's happening. Like my mother was a child during the Blitz in World War II. And it very much impacted her, but she was very young.
Right.
She's 84 now, nearly 85.
Wow.
And she does, as it happens, have an autoimmune disease. But the way in which for very young children, it particularly, I think, goes in the body because there's no way to intellectualize what's happening.
Right, exactly. And they're communicating so much through their body anyway at that point, right? We're communicating so much with gestures, with sounds, with other things than just language.
The body's also very open. The body is just figuring out that it's a body and it's in the world.
Yeah.
I think. So I know I took this to a very different place, but
I love it.
Understanding how our habits around voice are also tied to habits locked in the body. That's really the connection that I think applies to voice, which is why in training to improve your voice, if you have blocks in your voice, it can be an unexpectedly, for some people, unexpectedly emotional experience. Because as you unlock the voice, you unlock you unlock whatever has been held back or oppressed or suppressed.
Oh my gosh. And some people have very soft voices and very quiet voices. And sometimes I've noticed that it can be tied into fear making themselves small, because they were maybe raised in a situation where speaking up wasn't.
It's safer to be small.
It's safer to be small. And it's safer to not have a loud voice or have an intrusive voice because, I think I'm sort of somewhere in the middle. Like I value timbre and tone a lot in conversation. And I think that I can sort of really tell right away when someone is moving into a tone that's not within the scope of sort of friendliness or whatever, either sad or angry. Or so I'm very in tune to that. My ear is very in tune to that. So I don't really mess around too much with conversations if I know they're going a certain way. I'm like, I'm good. I'm going to go this way because I know where this is going. But just in terms of tone. But yeah, so I think that's a big part of it is, and for me, there's still stuff I need to release, and that's why I keep doing what I do. Like you're right. It is, I find that the more I work on certain things or the more I rap about certain things that are maybe part of my trauma or whatever, I rap different. My delivery is different. It comes from a more like natural place and not a more pushing forward place, which is when I'm rapping angry, which is fine. I like both. I'm happy with my angry raps. But that's part of it. Is I release through doing. I'm also a very big crier. Like when I a lot of, you know, sometimes men in general, they may not. Or okay, I shouldn't say that, but it's been sort of the...
Well, in the US.
Yeah,
there's been this... Culturally, it's very different in different places, but in the US...
Yes, it's very culturally sort of looked at a certain way. If you're someone who is okay with crying, who doesn't hold it back, or who actually, like me, needs it. Like, I actually purge through it. It helps me so much. I feel...
Me too.
Always feel better. After I cry. I always feel better after I cry. And it's weird. And people always want to be like, don't cry or don't like, but what they don't understand is that healing hurts. That's part of it. Like healing hurts sometimes, and healing is the crying, and the crying is a healing. And
I think don't cry may be actually code for don't make me feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Or don't touch on my emotions because we tend to feel a natural empathy. Often, not everyone does, but there's an emotional reaction of some kind when someone in your vicinity is crying.
Completely. And it's also maybe, I don't want to take care of you right now.
Right. Right. And that's also an understandable feeling.
Totally. Totally valid. Totally valid.
Yeah. I would actually like now to ask you to do a little bit of beatboxing for us.
Oh, yeah. That sounds fun. Okay. Let me do this. Okay. One second here. Thank you.
and I feel like thunderous applause should be coming your way right now. I'm a thunderous applause machine of one. It's fabulous. It's always really impressive when I hear you do that.
Thank you.
Always really impressive.
Thank you.
Quickly, how did you learn?
So fifth, sixth grade, I heard Dougie Fresh on the radio, and my cousin and I were like, we're going to learn how to do that. And he was doing some like little thing. And I was like, I don't know what he's doing. So I had to just learn it and figure it out. And so we just spent a lot of time. But my cousin told me, because I tell that story, and he says, actually, it was like fourth grade, you were already making sounds, like I remember. And I was like, oh, wow. So yeah, I would play with my little G.I. Joes. And I would do all explosions. And yeah, that was where I developed the kind of sort of like vocabulary in a way, or like just like the template for where the sounds would come from. And then the first time I really realized I was really into sound was when I was sitting in my mother's, this is another sort of beatbox origin story too for me, is like I was sitting listening to my mom's washer, and I, because she had just put in, and I think I was supposed to wait for it to come out to put in the dryer. And she was like, oh, just go and just, you know, I'm like, Mom, it's not ready yet. Just go, it'll be done. And I was like, all right. So I go and I'm hearing, and I'm like, oh, that's like a rhythm. And I started like hearing a rhythm in there, and I started like beatboxing to it or something.
It was in you. You were born with this.
Yeah. And I remember thinking like, sound is everywhere. That's part of what I do. And so, yeah, I was a dancer at first. I used to do popping and breaking, lots of dancing. And I think that kind of, and I, oh, but I want to, you know, I have a voice too. So I was a writer, big into poetry and all that stuff. So it was a natural marriage that eventually I would sort of rap, because dance music, poetry, rapping is, you know, that's what hip hop is. And beatboxing is just a byproduct of me having, you know, wanting to just always be doing something. My mother was like, you would never sit still. And I'm like, so it's just part of me sort of needing to always do something. So, but when you can beatbox, it just developed. People always say, how long did you practice that? I said, I don't know. I just do it. Like when I'm walking down the street, when I'm just, and so you end up putting in those quote unquote, what did they say? 10,000 hours or what do they say out to be a expert? Like, I think it's like 10,000 hours or something like that. I don't know what it is, but there's saying, and I ended up putting in that much time just by, you know, walking around and doing it all the time, which is
wonderful.
Sometimes a problem. Because I teach beatboxing, and I teach it to little ones. And there's been many times where a parent will come up to me and say, yeah, thanks for teaching my kid how to do that beatbox thing. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, he does it all the time. I'm like, oh, okay, sorry. And so I realized that I had to do a disclaimer. And now every time I teach beatboxing, I say, and everybody, if you want to show your parents or anybody, here's what you do. You go to your room by yourself and you practice. And then when you have something you want to show, that's when you say, hey, dad or mom or friend, check this out.
That's great. So, that's great.
Yeah, had to do that.
Permission, consent, yeah. Even in beatboxing. Yeah.
Sound consent.
This is great.
And spit consent. Don't nobody want them.
Oh, that's true. That's
especially
true.
Nowadays,
the masks. Oh, I'm, yeah.
It's been tough. I've had to teach beatboxing during quarantine, and it's been weird.
Wow.
Yeah.
I bet.
It's been weird. So that's a whole nother thing. Yeah. So it's been.
So I'd like to ask you to share a disempowered experience with voice. And you can interpret that so many ways, physically, psychologically, emotionally.
It's hard to nail it down to one experience, but because this is something that happens, but I'll say this one experience. So I did a play at California Shakespeare Theater, and at the Bruns Amphitheater. And it's a nice big space, right? Amphitheater, got to be loud, got to use projection. We're doing the, you know, regional run. So it's going to be, you know, what is that, like six or seven shows a week, right? Six shows a week at least. And I found, you know, as an actor, as someone who constantly fluctuates between using technique as a rapper and using technique as an actor, and they're two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not the same. And if I acted on stage the way and used my voice the way I rap, I wouldn't be able to do one or two shows.
Right.
My technique has to fluctuate, and I have to go into actor technique, which is completely different.
Were you struggling with losing your voice?
Yes. So I was struggling with being able to maintain all of the things that you want when you're acting in a 6 shows a week and 7 shows a week, and you're trying to hit those peaks that your character has. I did a total of 6 characters.
Mm.
So there's voice fluctuations for all of them.
It's a physically highly demanding space.
Yes.
It's outside, and it's usually very cold, even yes. in summer.
So those factors told me, oh, I see. Like, now I understand why people don't try to do, like, you don't see, like the best amazing theater actors. Like, let's take Ian McKellen. He had to hit this thing every single night, and it was like crazy vocally demanding. And I'm thinking to myself, how the hell are you doing that? Like, but it's because their entire dedication is to one thing, and that's being in that play, doing that show Tuesday through Sunday, and taking care of your voice so much, like nothing else, and just all these techniques about tech. And I'm a hustler, so I was doing the play, and then I was teaching. And teaching voice is not the same as rapping voice is not the same as acting voice. And then I was rapping. And so my voice was just like going through all these different fluctuations. And I realized that's just too much. So I think I learned that, first of all, less is more when it comes to the voice. And also, I just learned that I have to have the discipline if I'm going to have that kind of workload. And I just realized that no one should have that kind of workload. So I scrapped that out of my brain and realized that, yes, in order to do this kind of work, you have to be very careful and take care of your voice. And even then, you're only human. Like, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I just feel like it was just a lot, you know?
It's a very challenging space.
Yes.
It's a very brutal space.
It's kind of
the Siberia for actors.
Yeah, and I'm
something
doing
like that.
Love scenes across, like, huge balcony, like I'm supposed to be yelling across a balcony to my love and all this stuff. So yeah.
And you know, the Globe, the original Globe, was much smaller than that.
Oh, okay.
So in Shakespeare's time, the space was such that although they still required huge vocal power, they had these really high tiers, and the yard was much smaller.
Yeah.
So the audience size at that theater makes it very difficult as well, because it isn't intimate. Whereas outdoor theater that's intimate is certainly easier to project. And
yes, for sure. So that was kind of my
experience.
Yeah, and that's good. And I appreciate that. So that was my experience where I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I'll be able to do like this show the way I wanted to. And then it affects your acting.
Right.
Because if you don't have your voice and you don't have that, like your tool, the rest of you goes, oh, I need to compensate, or no, I don't. And you start getting in your head and all this stuff. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'd like to now hear one of your most empowered experiences with voice.
So there's a show I do with a nonprofit called Stage Right. And Stage Right is based out of San Francisco. And every year they would do these plays where they would bring in professional actors to act out these fifth graders' plays. And they were all fifth graders who wrote the plays. And the fifth graders wrote every single word. We were just there to kind of help them with structure and stuff like that. So they would bring in these professional actors, and I would always get to do the sound effects for the a special needs group that we worked with, and they were all autistic, and they had, the autistic children had written these plays. Incredible, like incredible plays that were a lot of very sonic based, because they would just, the way they would express and write was not always with like full complete like sentences. Sometimes it would be sound type stuff and just like expressions of emotion that needed to pop with sound so that the audience could get the full scope of what the, you know, the child was trying to express. And being in those rehearsals and watching them when you sort of express what they want, or if like there was an alligator, if there was a monster in their piece, and I would like and do all these like sound, it would just, I could just see their eyes just light up to see their words sort of come into like reality in a way and come to life. There's nothing like feeling like you're helping somebody realize their potential. And that's so empowering. And it just feels so good. And along those lines, I would do these similar type experience. I would do these performances for the, it's like a mental health awareness sort of like awards. I was called strictly just to do this beatbox performance. Like, I love the concept that I didn't say in there like, be mentally healthy, or like I didn't include it in my beatboxing thing. I just did my thing. Mm-hmm. and it was this kind of get, like the idea was that I was gifting a performance so that we could celebrate how great these people are. And there's something just really cool about feeling like people go, oh, that's one way that guy probably copes with life. And it's so true. Like, I definitely have an overactive brain, and I think a lot, and I have all these, and I have different little coping methods and things like that. But the one that's the healthiest is my expression and being able to just get it out. I don't have to talk. Like, I could tell you something right now. Like, to me, that means something, right? And so, so I think there was something empowering about that as well, is to help all these people go, oh, I'm worthy of this experience, and how fun is it that this person is doing that? And they must have so much going on in their brain to be able to do all that stuff, right? And it's really just kind of it's really powerful to have people feel appreciated just because you're there doing your thing. Like, I'm just in awe of people who work as social workers, who work as in these different facilities, helping folks who have these different things going on that are hard to, not everybody can work with folks like that. It takes special people to step up for people with special needs. So anyway, that was also another powerful experience. And I've done that multiple times.
It's also the story of connection, which is why rather early on in my work, I realized that was why I was acting. I wanted to connect with the audience around shared humanity. I wanted to feel a connection.
Wow. Yes.
And
yes,
it was much more satisfying then, when I was less worried about my talent or how's it coming across.
Exactly.
And certainly when you're talking about helping people in service, that is why I coach. That is why it's so exciting, helping people with voice. It's such a connective, humanistic experience.
And it reverberates.
Yes. Oh yes, you're planting a seed, and then they're going to, I've had a client whose young daughters ended up doing the exercises with her. And she and her husband became really engaged around supporting her young teen's voice in the world, her
there
daughter.
Yeah.
So that she would have a different experience than her mother, who had come to me for support and who was doing so well herself.
Right.
So I felt like, oh my gosh, all I'm doing is facilitating this.
Yes.
They're doing the work and taking it to this next level and taking it to other people.
And that's experience that you're explaining right there in terms of reverberation has happened to me multiple times with my beatboxing, because I teach it and I teach kids, little kids, and I even taught some recent ones online, all kinds of stuff, right? When I teach kids, I only give them a vocabulary, and I give them a couple of beats that I know that they can, these are formulas for the beat, this is the actual beat, but because I notate it, but they have to take it on their own. And what's the best experience is when I see them a year or two later and they're like, fresh. I'm like, oh, you still remember? Because it's kinetic, and beatboxing is very like sort of, you know, it's there with you all the time if you want it. So yes, and that experience of it being passed on and seeing people pass it on to their kids. My daughter's doing it now, you know, because she just hears me. She's 7 years old. It's very powerful when young people, for me personally, when young folks can get the beatboxing. That's another powerful experience I have constantly, is when young folks are, and they get it. Especially, I taught preschoolers in Berkeley before even first grade, before even kindergartner. They were able to do the beatboxing thing. So that was a very new experience for me. I was like, oh, I'm going to see what I can do.
That's
with
amazing.
Just sounds. And it worked. Yeah, it's amazing. So yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
So now I'd like to ask, whose voice do you particularly like?
Well, first of all, I like your voice. I really
yes,
love your voice.
You
I've always
that.
Loved
Thank
your voice.
Thank you.
And it's not just that it's an accent. I love that it, I just love the timbre of your voice. It's very nice. For me, I'm going to have to go sort of backwards a little bit. And you're probably going to be like, wait, what? Why do you like their voices? But you got to remember, I grew up as a kid watching television a lot and watching sitcoms. So there's voices that are dear to me. And then there's voices that I'm like, oh, my God, you have an amazing voice. Okay. So I grew up listening to people like Gary Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up watching Three's Company, and John Ritter is just like another sort of voice that I just grew up listening to. Those are voices that are dear to my heart. They both have passed. I also loved Edward James Olmos.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great actor, but he knew, he always added a little tinge in there in his voice. He knew he had the voice. So it's like, I just feel like he knew how to use his voice as opposed to rely on it. But he knew mm-hmm. how to use it, right? So mm-hmm. there's a difference. I'll go to the guy who, people don't like this guy, but I like his voice. The host of Sword and Scale.
Okay.
It is a very big true crime podcast. And he just has a great voice for storytelling. And I think that's just something that I've found that I gravitate towards, is people with storytelling. Oh, by the way, I did a for ACT, American Conservatory Theater, in San Francisco, mm-hmm. I did an audio book, an audio story. So I've released it as, I haven't released it on all the platforms. I released it on my own personal Bandcamp page, but it's called Return to What? And it's about kind of being an actor during quarantine and just all this other kind of stuff. Like, not just that, but that's one of the factors. So that's another thing that is out there in the world that I'm going to get re-released soon so that it's on all the platforms. And it's this audio experience of me reading poetry that I wrote, spoken word, over beats that I made. So,
and I will include information so that you cool. can find Carlos and everything that he's doing
awesome.
In the podcast notes of this video or podcast, however you're taking this in. And finally, do you have a question for me?
Yeah. My question would be, was there ever a time that, and I have a feeling you might say, of course, but I hope this is not an obvious question, but was there ever a time where your voice and your accent worked against you?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And this is going to be such a weird one.
Mm.
Well, there's two. One is that there's been a real sort of, around the Queen's death, there was a lot of anti-British, which I think had to do with the monarchy,
yes.
and colonialism, all very understandable and valid
yes.
feelings come up.
Yes, yes.
And my son started being teased at school. As you know, he's half Guatemalan. he was having some kids tease him around being British.
Wow.
He's also American, right? You know, but
he have an accent?
No. No. And he's at a very multi-ethnic school. Mm. It's very interesting because, and it could be very particular to the particular kids involved, but yeah. It was two white kids. So I just had a feeling it was about deflecting feelings around being white. So, and my son would say, I'm half Latino. And the Latino kids would go, oh, your father's from Guatemala, you're Latino.
Yeah.
So it was, as we say, in very old fashioned English slang, that was a turn up for the books.
Oh, I'm going to use that one.
Yeah, I really like it. There's some great old fashioned English slang, and I'm so out of date because I've lived here for so long. So I wouldn't understand a lot of what is said. Now,
it's gonna be in my next rap.
Like in my mother's era with slang. Yeah. The other thing is, and this is crazy, in the Bay Area, I went up for a number of classic English roles that I'd be particularly suited for. Like in England, I'd be cast that way. Alan Ayckbourn, Bernard Shaw, really, really heavy language, classic English, very English pieces.
Yeah.
And I never got them, and no one else English was up for them. And the director would always be asking me in the audition to say the lines in a way that was very American.
Oh.
So Alan Ayckbourn, Bernard Shaw, super subtextual, anything very particularly from the past, it's tonal, the way that you deliver a line ironically, it's subtle. They couldn't hear that, and they were wanting an obvious delivery that is terribly un-English. And so I think I didn't get cast because of that.
Well, it sounds like that might have been a good thing.
But yeah. Anyway. Yeah, but, it's fine. It's water under the bridge.
Yeah.
And totally. As you know, I can sound American, and I've done American roles. Yeah. My dad was American, but
totally.
And my own accent is transatlantic. As I'm speaking to you now, it's not one right. accent.
Right. Yeah.
But I just have to decide which way to push it depending on what's happening.
Totally.
And sometimes people are intimidated by me. And anyone who knows me or this podcast might find that surprising or might not. It just depends.
No, I could see it just vocally, but not.
Yeah.
I know you, so I would never. But yes, I guess I get it. Yeah.
It's stereotypes, whatever that is.
Exactly.
And you know, usually it works in my favor. People assume higher intelligence, which is not. I'm going to be the first to say has no bearing on the accent, but it is a projection onto the accent.
You're right.
So people will listen to me sometimes.
Totally.
I get listened to, which is something, a privilege I really understand as a privilege. But
yeah,
sometimes people just don't know how to take me. And there's a bit of, I'm doing a gesture where I'm sort of shrinking back, you know, and that can be very uncomfortable. But I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that can happen.
Yeah, that was not my reaction to you when we first. I was like, "You're great. This is awesome. Let's go."
Yeah, it was really fun. We met when Carlos was part of a group called Felonious. One Love Hip Hop.
That's right, Felonious. Yeah. Yep, and we had a little tag, One Love Hip Hop. Yep.
Yeah, it was. It well, I think the music was great. I absolutely loved it.
Oh,
a Bay
thank
Area
you so
band.
Much.
Do your plug for your podcast.
So my friend Dan Wolf and I are part of a group called Felonious, and we have a long history together, and we have a long history of sitting in cars, listening to hip hop music, smoking weed. So we decided to create a podcast called Raps with a W, a podcast about songs about weed. And about rap songs about weed, I should be specific, a podcast about rap songs about weed. So our podcast is takes you through the history of the first rap songs that were entirely about weed. So it's not a verse or a word here or there. It's where the song topic is weed and smoking weed. And so we break it down from the producer angle about the music and also lyrically and the raps, and we kind of take a deep dive into the song. And we go through, we're going to do about six songs, six episodes, and we're going to take you through chronologically through some of the biggest songs that have happened in hip hop history, that of songs that are about weed. And we're really excited about it. So yeah, look out for that.
And so when you check out Carlos's Instagram, which is going to be the best way to stay in touch with him, you will, if you follow him, you will get notifications on that and everything else he's doing, including the Telltale Heart. Because as you can see, he has a really varied and exciting output.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot. And I'm releasing music on Spotify under Infinite. But you can find all those links on my link tree, which is in my Instagram. So yeah, we'll get those.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you so much, Carlos, for speaking to me today. It's been a complete pleasure.
I'm so happy. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
You can find Carlos on Instagram at MC Infinite. That's at EMCEE Infinite. If you'd like more support with your voice and public speaking, please contact me. I do still have some spaces available for one-on-one clients starting in the new year. I'm SJ Harrison, and this has been On the Breath. You can find our podcast on my website, sjharrisoncoach.com, on Podbean and other major platforms. If you're a person who likes to see us as well as hear, all these episodes are on my YouTube channel, SJ Harrison Voice and Performance. If you like this episode, leaving a review helps people like you find us. Thanks for listening.